You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny. You've reached the Reading Envy podcast. We are recording on September 30th, 2021. And let me apologize in advance for my voice. It's not COVID, but I have been sick for a while, but I already had to postpone one recording. So we're going to make it work. And I just ask that you bear with me. But luckily, we have someone with a great voice back with us today. It's Ross O'Brien. Welcome back, Ross.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Now, I say back, but you know, a lot of people who might be newer to the show might not have heard your episode back in 2015. But you can go back and listen to that. It's episode 45. So it's been a while.
Pre-triple digits.
I know. But you're still in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Still trucking along. So tell us a little bit about what's been up for you.
To be honest, literally not a lot. You said sort of trucking along. I mean, one of the things that we have not been doing here in Hong Kong is trucking anywhere. There are obviously very different worldviews on how one deals with COVID. I mean, Hong Kong is quite similar to a lot of other places in Asia, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, and of course, China, under which Hong Kong's administration falls, where they've adopted this zero COVID tolerance, which to be positive about it, we live in a vibrant city of 8 million people who can all sort of go about their daily lives without much fear of it, because Hong Kong is a city long familiar with deadly pandemics. I mean, you remember the SARS epidemic. Hong Kong was the birthplace of SARS in 2003, which means that we all sort of wear masks and don't have a problem with it. And so there's a lot of compliance, a lot of orderliness, and there has been no local cases for months and months and months. But of course, that means that neither can we really freely travel out of Hong Kong. You know, anybody coming back into Hong Kong has to kind of be locked in a hotel room for three whole weeks before they can go home. So, we live, to use my snarky phrase, under an iron bubble. And one can debate whether that's better than the alternative. It does cause one to get itchy feet every now and again, I must say.
Oh, I bet. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording about how it's basically the opposite of where I am in the south of the United States, where people are just pretending it doesn't exist and the cases are growing up all the time. So it's just a different philosophy, shall we say.
Incredibly so. As a result, I think a lot of people obviously, you know, not being locked into one's home, but kind of being locked into a place, it sort of does change the way you approach life. I mean, a lot of people have been spending much more of their time sort of hiking out in the hills and doing things, being more intensely local about what they've done. And one of the things that I've been doing a lot more of, so I think this is probably a net benefit, is reading and using the time to contemplate or kind of better curate what I read. When one has some contemplative time on one's hands, you get a little bit sharper about figuring out what you should be reading and thinking about. So it's been a good mental exercise on that front.
Do you mean you're picking different books?
Yeah, to a certain extent. And again, I snarkily said off mic that in the frame of one of my favorite writers, Hunter S. Thompson, I kind of divide most of my books into the category of either fear or loathing. You know, fear are kind of books that I've been thinking about, well, the future of the world in a number of frontiers, you know, obviously looking at the environmental future, the future of technology. So that, of course, leads me to kind of plunk into speculative fiction and dystopian science fiction, but stuff that's not, that has kind of harder edges to it or forces me to think about what future states might actually be. on the loathing side, and this is probably a little bit more antagonistic than you're used to on this podcast, that I've been really thinking hard about future modes of government and how government should be kind of serving its people. Obviously, living in the shadow of China and seeing what's been happening in the dialogue between China and the world, I think a lot about the future of the Chinese state, the future of global relationships. So I guess I've kind of been, sorry, it's going to sound overly grandiose, but if a book doesn't have a big, big theme, I don't quite get into it. I know a lot of people kind of use this time to think about, you know, shutting off or doing pleasure reads, but to me, it's kind of had the opposite effect. I've kind of wanted to scratch bigger itches. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I definitely think it does. And I've seen people kind of have that response too, like they're going in for the longer books than they normally would, or, you know, finally picking up those classics.
I mean, unfortunately, I read Moby Dick last year, so I'm not ready to revisit that anytime soon.
I felt like once was enough, but then I went to a Melville birthday party, not a Moby Dick birthday party. Our English department does some creative things sometimes.
Okay.
And so some of them were reading their favorite passages from it. And I, you know, just listening to it in that kind of way, I was like, wow, you know, the writing is actually really good. Maybe I want to read that again. And I was like, no, I don't.
No, but definitely do go to Melville themed birthday parties every year. I think that's get it without the pain. It's funny you should say that because there's a Scottish poet named Robert Burns, and Hong Kong, for a variety of reasons, had a lot of Scottish traders in it back in the day. I mean, they were actually this is going to be one of the books that I'm going to talk about, the prevalence of Scottish trading houses is a big part of Hong Kong. And so every year on Robert Burns' birthday, there's this thing called a Burns night where you kind of sit around, drink whiskey, eat haggis, and read poems at each other until you are incapable of reading, which my only experience with the poet is over whiskey-drenched haggis late in the night.
Where does one get a haggis in Hong Kong?
You know what? I've never hosted a Burns night, so I've not had to deal with that. I've just been the recipient of them.
Well, which of your books touches on that? Do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I could do. Sure. So, yeah, I mean, well, so I have been reading a lot of big thematic history. To be honest, I'd probably prefer to read more historical fiction because I'm not kind of a history buff by habit. But if a book is fairly well paced and if there are enough sort of characters sort of nicely identified and sketched out in it, it sort of acts the same as a decent historical fiction novel. And that is definitely the case with this one, which is called Imperial Twilight. Longish subtitle is The Opium War and the End of China's Last Golden Age. It's by a historian called Stephen Platt. It is fairly balanced. I mean, it definitely draws more on British sources of the run-up to the Opium War in 1840. But it's a fairly balanced look at China and global trade starting from the 17th century, and how, much like Japan, China had closed off trade to just a small little colony that sat on the edge of Guangzhou, or Canton, as it was commonly known then, sort of, which was at the time kind of the second biggest city in the world after London, and how for several hundred years, most of the rest of the world traded with China through these little pinholes, trading communities. And over time, of course, the largely British traders kind of found ways to sneak in opium as a way of kind of supersizing their fairly limited avenue for trade. And it's an interesting, it really interests me that, and I'm not saying there's, I mean, clearly there's a lot of sort of malfeasance on the part of, again, as aforementioned, Scottish traders, because they were supplying a good that was neither sanctioned by the British government nor allowed to be distributed by the Chinese government. So, you know, they were very early narco-terrorists, if you like. But both the British and the Chinese were operating on such fundamental misunderstandings of each other for so very long, in large part because the aperture of their ability to interact with each other was so small. And again, that was also more by design of the Qing dynasty, which wanted to kind of limit the influence and the access that foreigners had to trade. It was also in the mindset and the worldview of the British, who couldn't get over the notion that this large, sophisticated, mature economy just didn't want to become exactly like them. So, you know, sort of these colossal misunderstandings on both sides, which culminated in a really unfortunate and totally manufactured series of wars, which, and not without irony, do I note that it sort of caused, like, gave the British access to territory of Hong Kong, where I find myself now, and it largely started the process by which the Qing dynasty ultimately fell. And it's important because, I mean, not only is in some ways this kind of global containment that we're having, where China and the US are largely kind of locking each other out of, or pushing back on each other and kind of creating these sort of separate parallel universes. But the instance of the Opium War and the subsequent treaties that China signed with the rest of the world are still a source of great anger and shame, and kind of motivate and inform a lot of Chinese political direction to this day. So I suppose, you know, the book's really well written, and it's got all sorts of, you know, interesting characters that again, like I said, like the best historical fiction. You know, you follow buccaneering smugglers up the Pearl River, and you see virtuous mandarins burning chests of opium on the shores of the river, and it's a culture war and a endlessly fascinating trade conflict. But it's also very much something that in many ways is manifesting and repeating itself today. And unfortunately, under the pandemic, I mean, I think we're now effectively in the same set of kind of virtually excluding ourselves from each other at a time when global trade is ever more important to everybody's success. I don't know whether to draw optimism or pessimism from this, but it is endlessly fascinating to me that these trends do end up repeating themselves somehow.
Yeah, and it's such a big one that it's almost a surprise that it would repeat itself. I don't know.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. You'd think, you know, yes, you'd think that we would be learning something from past experience. And then again, I mean, I think this is one of the things that sort of fascinated me most about the book, is that the clash, the ultimate opium war, sort of happened fully 200 years after these two cultures started trading and engaging. And I was like, did you guys not sort of get to know each other at all over that 200 year period? And the answer is actually no, not a lot. So, you know, the limits of the people's one's ability to kind of reach out and kind of explore and live amongst other people, and yet still fundamentally not take on basic understanding of other people and other cultures is, I mean, luckily we're still all, I think a lot of people still would like to try. I mean, I think hope springs eternal, but I'm hoping for more hope these days.
I just had to look this up. It made me think of this book, and it seems unrelated at first. It's travel writing. by Tim McIntosh Smith called Travels with a Tangerine. And he was following this monk from the Middle Ages path in like the Arabian Peninsula. But what he talks about is how travel is so dependent on whether you're in a phase where the world is opening or the world is closing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so he started out, this historic monk started out in a time period where there was a lot of peace. And so he was able to gain access to a lot, but then he hit up against the Black Plague. And so all of a sudden, you know,
things closed down around
things
him.
Closed down. People aren't as welcoming. Cultures are less likely to work together. And I've been thinking about that a lot in these last 2 years, you know, because we're in such a period of closure. And the funny thing about that period when, you know, Britain and China, and then I was thinking about the novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. Have you read that one?
I'm actually staring at a copy of it right now.
Was with the Japanese and the Dutch, right? But the same time period-ish, I think.
Probably 100 or so years earlier.
Okay.
But the same concept in that they were living in an extremely small colony outside a port in Japan and only able to trade from this one little vantage point. And they weren't allowed on the mainland at all.
Right. And that was so intentional by the Japanese and the Chinese governments. Mm-hmm. It was it's like the Western world wanted these trade agreements because of, like, I guess the ingredient or the supplies they needed, right? But they didn't think of it from a cultural perspective ever. They're just like, well, we need these things and you have these things. But it seemed like Japan and China were very aware of what impact it was going to have. Like, they were being protective and they weren't wrong.
Well, I mean, you know, again, sort of, and one of the things in both The Thousand Autumns and in Imperial Twilight, I think, particularly in Imperial Twilight, I mean, Platt goes on to describe that paranoia and kind of control issues guided their concerns more than was probably good for them. In other words, by being overly sensitive to foreign polluting ideas, they ended up causing huge rifts in society and opening them up to currency crisis and whatnot. Sort of the overly controlled mode ultimately led to their downfall. But you're right. In essence, they weren't wrong to be concerned that these were influences that could do them wrong. But
that parallel seems apt for now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I said, I worry in some sense we're heading into that world again.
Yeah. So does the author bring it into the present day, or does he mostly focus just on that era?
There are a few sort of allusions to, I actually don't know when the book was published, but I think it was not so recent as to kind of reflect upon, say, the current trade war. So, but certainly it was written, you know, within the rise of China and its role in the global economy period. So he's conscious of that, but I mean, he doesn't kind of bring it all the way up to, you know, the trade war clash with Trump or anything like that. That's not as pretty, but again, similarities abound.
Yeah. It does sound fascinating.
You know how, I mean, I'm sure if you ever read like a historical book about a place where you lived or been, invariably like all the names mentioned in this book sort of have reference points in the fact that every character in this book on the British side is a street name in Hong Kong that I've been down up and down 1,000 times. So
yeah.
It's a very that's why it's called Pottinger Lane. That dude was a real idiot. You know, sort of my esteem for some streets in Hong Kong has grown, and for many others has lessened as a result of reading this book.
Huh. It's like reading Gone with the Wind was for me, and like, oh, Wade Hampton, that's who that is. Because everything's named after a Confederate general. Yeah. Well, I'm going to move on to my first book. And I think there's not really some parallels, but just this idea of the world being open versus closed. I read Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. So I've seen this book for a while, but wasn't really feeling compelled to read it, mostly because it's long. Like you were talking about how like you're feeling more like picking up books like that. I always struggle convincing myself to read another big book. Plus, I'm supposed to be in the middle of this Barkskins read-along that I'm behind on, which is another historical fiction. But I picked it up anyway, and I like it was due at the library. I knew if I didn't read it, I would never read it. So I read, it's like a 600-page book, and I read it in 3 days. That's the nice part about being homesick, I guess.
Sure.
So it's about this pilot, this female pilot, and she does not actually have a historical presence. She is not real, but she feels real the way she gets written about. And her name is Marion. But the story goes back farther from that. So there's a boat that's crossing prior to the time that the Lusitania went down, and it explodes. And the captain saves his twin babies, and Marion is one of them. And so she has this trauma in her past. She ends up being raised by her uncle because her father goes to jail for abandoning the ship and all the people that died after he decided he was going to get on the lifeboat. And so that kind of starts out the novel. So you're in that period, you know, the World War One, and then the lull, and then the World War II era. So you follow her as she grows up. And so she does fly some planes for the Second War, mostly to relocate them and get them to where they're needed for the male pilots to fly them into combat, because she's not allowed to do that. But Great Circle is actually referencing, you know, flying around the world. And so she's ultimately lost on this journey that she takes as an older woman, not like old, but she's like moving toward this goal of going around the world, basically. So she takes off from New Zealand and goes north over the Arctic, and then back to Antarctica at the end. That's the plan. Or maybe that was vice versa. I think I said it the wrong way. She started in Antarctica and was going to end up back in New Zealand. The funny thing is that like that's the name of the novel. And you feel like that's going to be the point of the book, but it's not really the point of the book. And in fact, like by the time you get to the part where the author is writing about her actual trip, it almost feels like I'm not even sure she needed to include it. Because it's more about like, you know, the elements that made up her life. And there's some really compelling stories on the periphery, like her twin brother, his name is Jamie, and he never eats meat. And he's an artist, you know, very sensitive soul. And there's kind of like a little queer love story in there with him and some other people. And then he has to decide if he's going to fight in the war because he's physically fit, but doesn't believe in killing, not even animals. And so he has a real, you know, like a moment there. He actually loses a girlfriend that he loves because her father is in the beef industry. And he was, once he heard that he didn't eat meat, he's like, get out of my house. So that was a fun scene. And then there's a friend of hers, just because of, by virtue of, she's been living in Missoula. And so that's Montana. And she has a close friend that is friends with both of them named Caleb, who's actually part Indigenous. And so that's an interesting storyline too. Like he has a little storyline. And then every once in a while, you're pulled into the present day because there's this character named Hadley. She's an actress and she's playing Marion in a movie. So
does the time frame shift back and forth, or
it does, but not super often. And honestly, I always think about like, did this story need this part? I actually don't think it. That's probably maybe 10% of the story. Not super, like the character is not super likable, and I don't think she's supposed to be. She's kind of one of those, you know, she was a teen star, now she's transitioning to be an adult star, and you know, all the things that she's had to do and sacrifice and the fakeness of it, you know, that's kind of the theme of those sections. I'm like, yeah. Like we've kind of heard these things before. The interesting parts about her story have more to do with the people surrounding her in the same kind of way. So like her parents died in a plane crash. And then she's going to play this role of this woman who flies planes and disappears, you know. So that's some heavy stuff. And then she also connects with some members of Marion's family who give her access to Marion's journals that were discovered later after she disappeared. And so there's some interesting information that the reader gets about Marion that maybe you wouldn't have gotten if that hadn't happened. Sure. So I like her story being there for that purpose. But I honestly felt like the story, like I would have read just the whole novel just about Marion. I would have read a second novel just about her brother. Like I felt like the characters were so interesting and they're that's such an important like period of time, like not even just thinking about the war, but all the advances in technology, all the advances in feminism, how people's views were changing of like what was expected of people and how like all of a sudden it was kind of a period of more mobility, right? So like people weren't just staying where they were born and living their whole lives there, partly because of the war, but also just because of economic changes. It's just such a vibrant time. Even just that background, I thought the author captured it really well.
So generally, do you think the circle kind of refers to their lives and the cycle, the circuit of their lives and relationships?
I'm sure that metaphor is in play. It's interesting, to have that kind of layer on top of historical fiction, because I'll admit historical fiction is not my favorite genre, but I like it when the characters are well developed. And I guess it helps that like the characters in this case aren't the real part. It's the surrounding world that's the real part, which I thought was an interesting choice. Most of the time, historical fiction is about characters that existed. That gave the author a lot more room to move around in, which I think she did very well. And I hadn't read this author before, so I'm going to try some of her other stuff. But this is actually on the Booker shortlist. I don't know if I think it'll win that award, though. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
We'll see.
Wow. That's kind of actually that you just teed up the segue to my second.
Well, please. That's perfect.
Mentioned, the Booker. I mean, I know actually, to be honest, I know, you know, being an avid listener of your podcast, I know you're very up on awards and the award cycles. And I got a little bit anxious because I'm not so much kind of, I don't know that much about the award, all the various awards around novels and books. So I've fastidiously looked up whether or not this next one was up for any of the significant awards. And indeed it was on the Booker long list, but did not make the short list. And that's Kazuo Ishiguro's latest novel, Clara and the Sun. So it is not going to be a Booker prize winner. I don't, and has not won any, you know, significant awards. But I mean, obviously, Ishiguro is in possession of plenty of awards, including. But this is his latest. Have you ever read any Ishiguro? Remains of the Day.
Yes, I've read Never Let Me Go.
Yep,
and I've read Clara and the Sun. I bailed on Remains of the Day.
Okay. Okay. So you have read this one. So I'm not like the hugest fan, and the ones that I like the most are kind of when he's at his most, shall we say, Margaret Atwood-ish. That is to say, kind of very literate, dystopian science fiction-y. So Never Let You Go was one of my favorite books. And this one, as you know, kind of has that vibe. Well, it sort of, it shares obviously a number of common themes, and he goes into, you know, what is the role of a person in relation to every other person? What does it mean to literally serve other people? And of course, that's the theme that goes back right back to Remains of the Day, right? And sort of, you know, how do you define your worth as an entity in relation to the value you bring other people? And of course, in this one, it's laid pretty bare when the central character Clara is an artificial intelligence enabled doll companion in a world that And you've read it, so let me ask you, would you say that this world that it's set in is comprised of primarily children that have been genetically engineered, or are we just viewing the subset of the world where children are genetically enhanced for greater success and they are part of the elite minority? Which is the world's, what did you take away? Because I'm actually kind of not sure.
You know, I don't know that I'm sure either. I feel like at least in, because it's set in the UK, right? I felt like at least in the UK, there was something going on where it was almost required to modify children because otherwise they somehow weren't able to learn / I don't know. It was almost like they lacked the ability to mature and grow in the way that kids otherwise do. But I'm not sure he really gives you a lot of explanation as to why.
No, he doesn't. And you know, sort of, I think that's kind of one of his strong suits is that sort of he doesn't dive down the world building rabbit hole. He just kind of gives you, he sort of sets it up and allows you to fill it in with your own speculation. But most of the things are kind of plausible. It is plausible that in the future, large chunks of people, whether by fiat or just by a desire to get ahead, are trying to sort of turn their progeny into super children. And as a result, they become overly cerebral and poorly socialized. And so you need to bring in these artificial robots. But I mean, Clara is, of course, not an automatron. She's from very early stage, you see her as being incredibly empathetic for an artificial construct and naive, of course, in that same kind of robot discovers the world kind of way. But I think the thing that sort of struck me most about this is sort of, while it is a fairly dark and depressing tale in a lot of ways, because you are talking about how the human race is trying to sort of just apply patch after patch after patch of new technology and new design to try to get themselves right, and every new patch reveals yet another fault. But Clara is this incredibly optimistic and hopeful character who is, while reads somewhat naive, is also very soulful and is actually sort of digging from the get-go for deeper truths and sort of what makes people human. And I think that was sort of the most, it was the most hopeful view of what artificial intelligence and kind of new machine learning enabled technologies can bring us. I mean, obviously, much of the world is really concerned about the robots taking our jobs and, you know, Borgifying us into one soulless mass. But, you know, I think Ishiguro kind of considers a world where the machines actually do have the ability to bring a new dimension to what it means to be human. And I took a lot of hope from the book, even though it ends pretty sad. You know, it's the tale of a doll that's been kind of designed to basically be a helpmeet for someone who will only need it for a short period of time. I don't know. There was something very hopeful and joyful about how deeply this robot doll kind of got to the core of what it means to be human. Am I overthinking this?
Well, I just think it's interesting that you felt hopeful about it. I just felt sad mostly.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of sadness.
Yeah. Because it's like the humans in the book, like I was thinking about the mother in particular, you know, that time they bring Clara, they go to the place where she came from.
Right. So it's like a design studio /
Yeah, but it's not even there anymore, right? Because they've whatever that company is moved on, or they've gone bankrupt because some other companies moved in, which is, you know, the standard way of innovation. But that's not how Clara has understood it.
Yeah.
And maybe not even her little child that she's helping, because the only thing the child knows is from what Clara says, because it's like the parents have failed to actually explain anything to their kids.
No, that's true. I mean, it's a very classic tale of parental outsourcing.
And I guess that does go along with like just the kind of British outsourcing with the wealthier, like the nanny kind of concept. But yeah, I just keep thinking of that silly robot, like at the end, like it made me think of WALL-E a little bit.
Yeah, no. I get that. And I acknowledge all of that. But I mean, again, I just think there was something, you know how sort of there was this whole sort of theme where Clara, because she's solar powered, starts to sort of accrue more importance to the sun, and then and starts to, you know, almost sort of create her own little sun deity, you know, one robot doll cult of the sun. But then she very quickly kind of pivots to saying, oh, okay, you know, this isn't some all sort of knowing fire god in the sky. This is one component of what we have to, you know, use to get ourselves going on. So it's almost like she was kind of living the entirety of human consciousness in kind of an accelerated time frame and kind of getting to deeper truths very quickly. Like she was, I mean, obviously being, she was starting from scratch, but because she was obviously an AI built upon the rest of the world's data. I don't know. I as I say, you know, and I felt hopeful because the robot did kind of come at things from a very humanistic perspective, and maybe sort of was a glimmer of the world. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not sort of one of these sort of singularity nuts that think that humans and IT are going to merge into one entity. But I do think that, you know, as artificial intelligence becomes more important to us, it's, you know, I've got to hope that it's going to help make us better, more caring beings. And I got a glimpse of that from it. So
yeah,
I'm not going to apologize. I was optimistic.
No, I think that's good. I've been working with a writing seminar because where I work, all the writing seminars have librarians attached to them. And the topic of the seminar is artificial intelligence. And one of the things the professor keeps trying to get the students to understand is that, you know, the future is now for one thing, and artificial intelligence isn't just in the robots and those separate, you know, creatures that are created. It's, you know, it's how we use, you know, algorithms and all those things and sites that try to anticipate our needs, which in a weird way feels like something that would need empathy.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like Clara is in that vein in some ways, because she does seem to respond emotionally to the child.
Absolutely.
Which was different. I looked up the Nobel Prize, and I think with the Nobel, it's the one where it's not linked to a specific book, right? So it was just back in 2017 that he won it. So that wasn't too long ago.
Okay. Right. So this is his first, this would have been his first novel since then, right?
Yeah, that's true. I read it because it was on the Tournament of Books summer camp TOB that they, they always pick six books and then everyone reads them and votes, you know, votes for a winner. I think it actually won.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things he wrote a book which was kind of his sort of turn at almost Tolkien-esque kind of, or Arthurian legend style sword and sorcery called The Buried Giant, which was sort of looking at similar themes, but from the dawn of Anglo-Saxon civilization. And, you know, I think he's got a real talent for being able to plumb really big, deep ideas without, as I say, you know, going crazy on the world building or piling on a lot of stuff. He keeps the framework, you know, sufficiently lightweight, and so you can get through it and, you know, your head still has space to sort of think about the bigger ideas, and it's not sort of bogged down with the minutia of who did what where, almost like tone poems.
Yeah, I think especially Clara and the Sun has that kind of feeling to it, because it's almost impossible not to have this big visual component because you have to fill in the gaps.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was one of the very fortunate people who was able to read Never Let Me Go without having it spoiled for me, because I read it, you know, back by the movie. Day. Yeah. Or even just people talking about it. And that, like, if you can read it that way, it's an astounding book. There's just no other way to say it. And I love the comparison to Margaret Atwood. I hadn't really made that connection, but totally, like, that book could almost live in the same universe as the Mad Adam trilogy, right? Oryx and Craig. I was trying to remember the first book.
Two science fiction writers who probably don't like being called science fiction.
Oh, no, never. We know what they are, though. Well, I'm going to go into my second book because it talks about humans and technology in a different way, maybe more of a humorous way. It's Several People Are Typing by Calvin Kasulke. So I have to say, I listened to this in audio, and if you can get it in audio, it's so fun because they have all these different voice actors doing it. It is basically an entire novel written as a Slack channel. Oh, so I don't know if you know what Slack is, but a lot of people...
I
haven't used it a lot. A lot of people who work in technology or who work in teams that maybe aren't always in the same place use things like Microsoft Teams or Slack or, you know, one of these kind of chat things. And of course, a lot of people had to use stuff like this when everyone started working from home. So the setting for this is not pandemic related, but it fits inside that really easily. So it's a marketing firm in New York. And the entire thing is written as a Slack channel conversation. So I did read the Kindle preview, and I'm not sure I would have had the same positive experience if I'd read it in print, to be honest, because it just looks like a script, but it shows you like which side channel the group, the people that are talking are in. But what has happened is one of the coworkers has somehow become stuck in Slack. Like his body is in the reality, but his mind is stuck and he can't get out. And so every once in a while, there are these conversations with the bot, the help bot. And she'll try to help, but the searches he tries to do don't answer the question. And all of her answers always end with, "I'm just a bot though," which is really funny in the voice that the audiobook. There's all these people making up excuses to work from home. So like, as soon as one person does it, then everyone else is like, "Oh yeah, it's too icy out there. I'm just going to work from home today." So that part made me laugh because I feel like right now at work, everyone's supposed to be going back. But, you know, I think everyone is having that feeling of like, it was easy to work from home. And there's just there were some scenes in this. I was listening to it as I was driving and I was just cackling because you interact with people in such a specific way in places like that, because number one, they're your coworkers, right? But it feels so casual, and there's such a, every little space like this has its own conventions. And so there's all these, I was going to write down what they call it in Slack. It has its own little name, but like its own emojis, you know? So in the book, the author puts them in there in the way that you would type them to get the emoji. And so there's this whole dusty stick joke, because apparently Slack has this dusty stick that no one's ever explained. But then they start incorporating that into just the text. And so instead of saying, "I looked at that," they'll say, "I," and then it's the glasses, you know, it's just how all people talk in text, but to hear like spoken somehow is just funnier. I just really enjoyed it. And so then eventually the character, you know, is trying to make his way out of it. And then all these people get involved with each other outside of Slack too. And so you have to pick up on what the story is through just the chat that they're having in these spaces. So yeah, it's short. I think it's like a 4-hour audiobook. So the book is going to be short too. This is a debut from what I understand. I hadn't heard of this author before, but I don't know. I've been reading so many serious novels and long novels that it was a really good antidote.
No, that sounds great. And I like the idea of trying to kind of accommodate a new mode. It doesn't sound it sounds earnest. I mean, it sounds like a funny book, but it also sounds like it's earnestly trying to sort of figure out how to communicate in this new mode without being overly gimmicky. Sounds like it fits my big picture. How are we going to deal with all these new technology paradigms theme? So I'll definitely pick it up. And you suggest doing the audio
I think it's so fun. It reminded me when I was in high school, I did speech and debate competitions, and I always just did the debate side of things. But there are these people that would do like the group scenes, like the acting kind of stuff. It reminds me of something that you would see at something like that. Yeah, it's pretty fun. Well, we can move to your last book.
The reason I picked up this book is that in the reviews I read, it mentioned that it was based on another book that is very important to me in my life. And so I was excited to kind of see this as kind of a continuing on of the ideas and the thoughts expressed in, I'm sorry, this is going to sound a little bit overly grand, but Hermann Hesse, is it Hesse or Hesse? Can never remember, but, you know, the Swiss, the guy did Siddhartha, Steppenwolf, and again, another Nobel Prize winning guy. His last book was called The Glass Bead King, which was...
I love that book.
Do you? I love it too. I absolutely love it. And the reason I picked up The Betrayals by Bridget Collins is that all the early reviews said it's a book that owes a great debt to The Glass Bead Game. I was like, okay, solid. I love The Glass Bead Game. I like the idea of people trying to condense the universe, condense the world of thought and art and poetry and science and math and music into what's called a game, and it's really just kind of, it seems like a set of abstract designs, references, this whole notion of kind of the world of the mind trying to compress and condense and refine the big ideas that guide our lives into a series of patterns. It's just a really compelling big idea, and it's always carried me for a long time. Interestingly enough, I first read it from a friend of mine who said, hey, you like Dungeons and Dragons? This book's about a game. You should read it. And I was okay, fine. But it's, of course, so much. It's both about a game and not about a game. You know what I mean? But this book in particular, The Betrayals, unfortunately for me, is just really only about the game. In the Betrayals, obviously, or sorry, in the Glass Bead Game, there's this fictional country where a number of the best and brightest have kind of gone on to live a life of quiet contemplation and sort of figure out how to work their thinking about life, the universe, and everything into these, you know, beautifully patterned games. And that kind of exists in The Betrayals. It's sort of set in a fictional, non-named European country, kind of around the 1930s. So it's lots of parallels with the rise of fascism in Europe. And there is a central character named Leo, who was once a student of the game, who has become the minister of culture in what is becoming a very kind of fast and furiously fascist state, who gets kind of cast out. He sort of doesn't play the game in politics well. He loses his position as minister of culture, but he doesn't get completely thrown out. He gets sent back to be kind of like a cultural attaché to his old great game school. And then he kind of rediscovers his love for the game, rekindles his love of another player who played the game and was there when he was a student. So it's kind of, I mean, it's very quite a lot of the novel is kind of set in the school, and it's told in the present time and also in flashbacks when he's living the life of a very callow, rich kid who befriends the oddball, who obviously is a brilliant student of the game, and they strike an odd couple relationship, and this was a seminal event in his life. And it is kind of repeated in his rediscovery of his interests in the future. There is an endless number of little mini campus intrigues around the fate of the school, the role of the game in life, the role of this new fascist state in promoting the game. And while it all sounds really grand, it just comes off, to my mind, rather small. Because there's way too much being placed on the proper way to execute the game, the proper way to behave to one another. But these characters, to my mind, are not fully realized. There's a lot of overblown sentiment, people getting way too concerned about little internal politics in a school environment that are supposed to mirror the bigger world, but we don't get enough sense of what that bigger world is. We're just sort of told that there's kind of a Mussolini slash Hitlerish type kind of father figure in the background who's slowly turning the wheel of fascism in the country, but it never, you know, the stakes don't seem high, and all the discussion of the game gets very finicky and small, but doesn't connect it to these big ideas. So ultimately, and I don't mean to trash the book, I was disappointed because it treated the game too much like a game and not as Hesse did, as a launching pad for a commentary on how we should approach an intellectual life. And I've never been a big fan of campus novels or you know, books sort of set in school, and I didn't, and no offense to Harry Potter fans, but it felt all a little bit too, you know, Hogwartsy inside baseball to me. I mean, I'm glad I read it because it kind of rekindled my thinking about the Glass Bead game, but I was kind of disappointed that it took the themes of the Glass Bead game far too literally and didn't do enough with them.
Yeah, it's almost like it trivializes it or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is her second kind of fantasy, high concept fantasy novel for adults. I guess she has, I've not read any of them, she has a long history of writing young adult novels, and I guess the sort of campus intrigue stuff definitely is probably from that life. And I know lots of people enjoy those books. I'm not trying to slight them, but that definitely is not my bag.
Well, I think it's fair to say this is what I went looking for, and it just wasn't that.
yeah, exactly.
And I'm completely wrong. I've actually never read Hesse, or Hesse, however you say it. I always get these two book titles confused. The book I remember liking is The Glass Room by Simon Maurer. It's
okay.
not the same. No. I have Hesse on my list of, you know, people I feel like I should have read by now. But
yeah,
well, The Glass Room is about Czechoslovakia during World War II. So, yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, sort of similar. Thematically, it's in the same place. I mean, I think, you know, this is the novel that Hesse wrote kind of about Germany during World War II, and eventually got himself booted to Switzerland as a result. I don't know. You should pick it up. It's a bit, but pick it up when you're ready for, like, you know, the ultra big conceptual idea time. I mean, I don't know what time of year that it's best to read those types of books. It's quite good. And as I say, you know, I'm very impressed that this fantasy writer tried to take on these big theories, big ideas, but I think she probably should have swung a little harder.
Well, I had never heard of the author at all before, so thank you for talking about her.
Sure.
Are there books that you're looking forward to reading next, or anything you're already in the middle of?
Yeah, I'm really okay. So I love, kind of classic noir type fiction, Hammett and Chandler and whatnot. And not too terribly long ago, I stumbled across, I think his name's in the zeitgeist quite a bit. A guy named S.A.
Crosby, I think. Is that
Crosby? Sorry. Yes, S.A. Crosby, who kind of writes some fairly realistic noir from a rural Virginia perspective and vantage point of the African American experience in poor rural Virginia life. And I mean, I guess it's noir in that it usually his books usually involve, you know, a guy who needs to do one last score and then he's out. These books are set amongst sort of modern day concerns of race and class and money and lack thereof. And the book that I'm kind of waiting on, let me say waiting on, I've got a hold in on my Libby service. You probably can explain to me one day why it is that something that is a virtual copy is still on hold for several weeks, but I am still 7 weeks away, according to Libby, from being able to read Razorblade Tears, which is the latest by S.A. Cosby. I'm looking quite forward to it.
Yeah, I keep hearing about that author, and I guess we should say it's Cosby and not Crosby, like I had said.
Oh, sorry.
No, that was me. Sounded right, but yeah, that's someone I definitely need to read. It's not my usual genre, but I've heard he's just so good. Well, and I right now I'm in the middle of a book that actually I nominated for my book club and they all discussed on Monday, but I didn't go and I hadn't read it. So, but I'm getting there. I'm about halfway through. It's called Maybe Esther, A Family Story by Katya Petrovskaya. It's about this woman who, it's a memoir, so it's nonfiction, but she's trying to piece together her family history after, so they were Jewish, living in Poland and Russia and Germany. And of course, after the world wars and communism and all these things, there's not a lot of actual artifacts or even, you know, records anymore. And so she's connecting to people that used to know her specific family members. It's very interesting. It's a different part of, I think, that whole area than you usually read about. Like for one thing, her family was very heavily involved in the creation of schools for what they called deaf mute people then. Of course, I don't think that's the politically correct way to say it now, but they were more known in those circles because of that. So there's, you know, that created one pathway for her to track people down. And then of course, being involved with the Jewish faith, there was, you know, like a rabbi who remembered someone, or anyway, it's just kind of interesting to kind of walk with her through that journey. I always like a research story, and I guess in some ways that's what it is.
Yeah.
So it's just interesting. I always say I don't like to read World War II stuff, but you know, it's so central to the story of the world and the people who are living now. And it's just a different way through that part. Ross, thank you so much for talking books with me today. I know it's like getting late into the night where you are.
Well, I mean, this I spend a lot of time, you know, I was joking with a friend of mine. I tend to do all these calls when the person on the other end is doing their morning drive time radio voice, and I'm doing the late night jazz voice because it's at the end of my day. So thank you for putting up with the alternate energy level.
Yeah, my energy is down. So, you know, what can you do?
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode at readingenvy.com.